It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Anoush Zamarodi. On the show today, radically different approaches to life. We've talked about improvising, pivoting, and now plan.
What we had in common, and sometimes it was unspoken between us, is that we wanted these wild lives.
Christine Tompkins has lived an incredible life. She was one of the Patagonia company's first employees. Then she became CEO and ran the company for 18 years. But then she was ready for a change. That's when she met Doug Tompkins, the founder of the North Face Company and co-founder of Esprit. He had sold his shares in both companies, moved to Chile, and was getting ready to embark on a new mission.
Doug was really committed to spending the last third of his life looking at ways to slow down what he saw as the trends of a globalized economy and the degradation of wildlands, nature in general. And I was a year and a half behind him. I wanted to retire from Patagonia, end my role as CEO after so many years. And so when we got together, that's what we had chosen to do with the next and probably final stage of our lives. Some of it was moderately planned. Some of it was just commit, as Doug always said, and figure it out later.
Doug and Christine's goal was, well, unheard of. People talk about dedicating their lives to saving the planet, but they wanted to preserve huge territories of land in South America and eventually create national parks similar to some of the most famous places in the U.S.
Yellowstone, West Yellowstone, Jackson Hole, all these places that if you protect them, people want to come and see these jewels of a nation.
But how to pull it off? They made a plan. Use their wealth to buy land. Lots of land. It was the 1990s. They moved to the hinterlands of Chile, a place Doug had always loved and which still had a chance at being preserved.
Roads were starting to come into the extreme south of Chile, so mining became an issue, logging became an issue, all the things that here in the United States we'd been seeing decades before. And so in many ways, we got there at that inflection moment for the extreme south of Chile. There were still extraordinary territories, pristine temperate rainforests, and massive grasslands that could be acquired and saved and restored.
Here's Christine Tompkins on the TED stage.
30 years ago, when my late husband, Doug Tompkins, and I began working on land conservation projects, we knew we would invest everything we had in terms of our time and resources to slow down the freight train of development that we saw destroying the natural world. As climbers, ski racers, wildlife people, we had long begun to witness with our own eyes, and it was time for us to react to those things that were oh so clear to us. We committed ourselves to saving as much wild habitat as we could, at first by simply buying land, ultimately acquiring over 2 million acres of key habitat in Chile and Argentina.
Take me through, if you would, I'm sure each acquisition of land was different in its own way, but was there sort of a pattern that you established about how you identified where to go next, how you went about securing it? Like, what was the process?
First of all, you're looking for the greatest impact possible. So if you're buying 200,000 acres, what is the absolute maximum impact that that purchase can have? Is there federal land around it that could be part of a package with the government someday? Maybe that's another 500,000 acres. Who are the neighbors? What's the temperature of the local towns? Ecologically, are they key? So every one of them, I would almost say, is sculpted before a commitment. And we say, okay, we're going to take the bet here. We're going to invest in it.
and we're going to work like dogs to get it returned back to the citizens of Chile or Argentina in the form of a new national park. And also, I think you have to remember that we were flying every day in these bush planes that we had.
Every day?
5 days a week, 6 days a week. We're in this roadless farm in the middle of this million-acre temperate rainforest. It rains 250 inches a year. It's on the toe of a wildly ferocious fjord and all those things. No electricity, no phone, just HF radios. But there's an airstrip within 100 feet of the front door. So for us, getting around meant running out, jumping in the bush plane, taking off, and we're in the kind of high foothills of the Andes, so this is very tricky flying. We would go all over looking at land, flying, landing in another grass, maybe 300 meter strip, meeting with team members, take off again, go to another one. So almost everything was by plane.
Lest we give people the impression that you and Doug would just fly over land and say, okay, we'll take that.
Oh, no.
It doesn't work like that. Can you explain what the reaction was as you started to buy up acres and acres? Mm-hmm. Because people were like, who are these two rich white people?
Well, that's right. Absolutely right. I mean, you can't buy land that's not for sale. You can't buy land from people who don't want to sell it to you. So these were all normal transactions. But when people began to realize that we were buying up, say, 50,000 acres, 100,000 acres at a time, and this was forested areas, primeval forest, and not planning to cut the trees, that's when an era of suspicion, mistrust, downright anger toward us began, and it really started with the presidency. The particular president who happened to be in power in the early 90s felt that what we were hoping to do was very disagreeable. So, yeah, it started 4 or 5 years of controversy in the papers, often, if not daily. People thought we were going to establish a military base for Argentina to finish Chile off once and for all. All of these alarming descriptions of what we could be up to. And, you know, today I understand why it happened. It was overwhelming that the two people could be doing what we said we were doing. And it took a long time, and death threats and having our phones tapped for years, and the team members working in both countries. This was really hard on them. I mean, I look back on it now, and I'm surprised by how naive we were that that might not take place.
I was about to ask.
Honestly, you know, you learn a lot in 30 years.
But was there a point where you thought, why do we even have to be here to do this? Let's just go back to the U.S. and have our team take it from here? Because, you know, literally your lives were at risk. Your phones were tapped. You were getting death threats.
No, we never did. We never thought, oh, God, let's get out of here.
After years of distrust, public sentiment slowly started to shift. Because in 2013, Doug and Christine made their first donation of land, 37,000 acres that expanded Argentina's Perito Moreno National Park. In 2014, they donated 94,000 acres in Chile's Tierra del Fuego, adding to a national park there and establishing a protected area of roughly 370,000 acres. And another nature sanctuary in Chile that they'd worked with the government to create became accessible, which meant
a lot of the infrastructure that we'd been working on, trails, restaurant, little hotel, campgrounds, all of that became open for the public.
So their plan was finally coming to fruition. But then In 2015, tragedy struck. Doug, always an outdoor adventurer and risk taker, was on a kayaking trip with friends. When the weather turned, he flipped out of the boat and couldn't get to shore, eventually dying of hypothermia. In 2015, your husband was on an adventure kayaking and did not come home alive. And you say that the big, audacious vision of Doug's kept you in one piece after he died.
Yeah. It was a tomahawk to my forehead. It wasn't just a moment of grief. But I was always a fighter, really. And in this moment in my life, I knew we have to finish this. And this is the team led by Sofia Hanonen in Argentina, Carolina Morgado in Chile. We decided we have to go do this. The big risk was holding all of these big parks and all of the costs of all the infrastructure, building it, completing it, maintaining it. So I just went through everything we had, and in each one, okay, this is what done looks like. And within 2.5 years, all the parks were national parks. And we did them all at once.
In 2018, Christine and Chilean President Michelle Bachelet signed a decree to create a network of 5 new national parks in Chile and expand 3 others, adding a total of more than 10 million acres of new national parklands to Chile's system of protected areas. And they've added more since. To date, Christine's organizations have created
15 new national parks, enlarged 3 or 4 others, for a total of around 15 million acres.
This roughly doubled the national park systems in Chile and Argentina, with territory that put together is the size of Costa Rica.
This was what we were looking for, pushing ourselves to some new level of commitment in all aspects of our life.
They wouldn't have worked otherwise.
No, you know what? I think you're right.
There are some who don't agree with your approach to conservation because buying acres of land and keeping it pristine doesn't necessarily add to the GDP of a country. I mean, we hear this a lot when we talk about climate change, that the richest countries, those that caused all these problems, won't now allow the poorest ones to get a shot at being industrialized and growing the wealth of their population. What do you think?
Well, it isn't true that you're taking production out of a territory when you create national parks. I think we have to be careful about imagining protected areas are just closed up as if the air's been sucked out of them. I say we're changing what it produces. Employment inside the national parks, tourism business, economic activities in the local communities. If you make a national park or just preserve an area and the local communities and regional communities don't absolutely, visually, tactily benefit from it, where is that 50 years from now or 100 years from now? It's not going to work. And we're not interested in just seeing that nature is protected. We also have responsibility to our own species. The importance is absolutely equal. You can't do one without the other. Dignified, healthy human communities have a much greater chance if natural systems are respected and cared for, because we won't make it in the absence of a healthy ecosystem. I mean, there's a chance for that. Will we know? Certainly I won't in my lifetime.
How do we get more people to think in that long term, though? Because I think some people would say, well, you had the financial luxury of being able to think that way.
Well, I mean, in our case, it helped us work faster. And I'll be really honest with you. Your question is a good one. And having really read a lot about the collapse of various civilizations, we humans only really change our behavior in a crisis. Otherwise, it's just too difficult. We don't have the spine. We don't have the willfulness to look at what we're doing and collectively decide we're going to change the way we live so that our grandkids and great-grandkids can live even remotely well. It's hard to imagine what we can do, but that's also a fallacy. There are a lot of things people can do. I get asked every time I speak in public, what can I do? What should I do? And I always say the same thing. I'm just meeting you for the first time. I don't know where you live, but mostly I don't know what you're good at. And let me tell you, that's where you have to start. You don't have to have money. You can be anywhere in the world and take a hard look at yourself. What am I really good at? And go give it away. Go do that. Because if we don't participate in our future, it is an abdication of our future. And I don't think most people want to live like that.
That's Christine Tompkins. She's the president of Tompkins Conservation and former CEO of Patagonia. Her next big plan is in full swing, by the way. She and her team are bringing back keystone species like the jaguar to these national parks and the surrounding regions. Learn more in both of Christine's talks at TED.com. And you can also see her in the National Geographic documentary, Wild Life. Thank you so much for listening to our episode, Improvise, Pivot, Plan. It was produced by James Delahousie, Rachel Faulkner-White, and Matthew Cloutier. It was edited by Sanaz Meshkinpour, Katie Monteleone, and me. Our production staff at NPR also includes Harsha Nahada and Fiona Guerin. Our executive producer is Irene Noguchi. Our audio engineers were Robert Rodriguez and Patrick Murray. Our theme music was written by Ramtin Arablouei. Our partners at TED are Chris Anderson, Roxanne High-Lash, Alejandra Salazar, and Daniela Valarezzo. I'm Manoush Zomorodi, and you have been listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR.